Flying Service, 1937. Better play, that operation continued up until the war in 1939. Young Eskimo boy at Bethel obliged me, was warming up the airplane, set it on fire, and it went up in smoke. In the meantime, the Good News Bay Mining Company had decided they would like to have more modern airplanes and not fly with ever fly the night pilots coming on, because Charlie Johnson, there, one of the partners, had got killed in an airplane accident at the mine. So they wanted to buy, loan me the money to buy an airplane. Jimmy Dodson had started his flying service with Stinson Reliance Gullwings, so I thought, well, that looks like a pretty good airplane. Seemed like it runs all the time. So I bought one in 39, in the spring of 39, in the fall I bought a Stinson A trimotor from American Airlines, who incidentally was, had some years before that, was also run the Alaska Airways that Bob Ellis and Bob Gleason were involved in. So things went a little better then. When the war came, I had three of these airplanes. In 1939, I asked Oscar if he wanted a job, and he'd come up and join me. And he was my right-hander for a number of years. Oscar Winchell, who had dedicated his life making my life miserable, but teaching me how to compete and how to be tough, also went to work for me during the war. By the end of the war, we had two Stinson A trimotors, three single engine gull wings, and I bought then a surplus airplane from Electra, Lockheed Electra. Not the kind you see flying around. This one had two engines, 10A. This airplane I later sold because the price went up so high that I could make more money selling it than taking the capital gain than to fly it. When the DC-47s became available, surplus, we bought those, and we then went. We had gone, we had the first 5 years had been without radio or any communications except ham radios along the river, but no radios in the aircraft. The Reliance and the Stinson A brought the first radio in the aircraft. We had a station at Platinum, the Ray Peterson had a station at Platinum, at Bethel, and Anchorage. The, of course, with the DC-3s, when they come along, and the C-47s, we were on instruments. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, with that came subsidy to finance them. 1945, at the end of the year, in the meantime, I had picked up the Bristol Bay Air Service, Bert Roof's outfit operating into Bristol Bay, and I had picked up Jim Dodson's flying service from Fairbanks down the, operating down the Yukon and as far as McGrath and Flat and Ophir. I bought these companies, and then at the end of the war, then we decided we'd create a merger, and we merged the old, got the old Gillum route, which had been bought by from the Gillum estate by Howard Pollock, who had prior to that sold his airline to Alaska Airlines. This is Bob Ellis's lineage of airlines. This is just a touch of it. There's quite a history in all of them. We had the mail out of Fairbanks then, and we merged into Northern Consolidated. This was done in 1945. I was the company's president at the time, and the CAB approved it on July 1st, 1947, and these Bush operators that had grandfather rights under the Civil Aeronautics Act of 1938 were then merged into Northern Consolidated, which got the certificate. These companies in 1958, we put both Ween, who operated in the north, and ourselves in southwestern Alaska, bought the first jet-powered airplanes in Alaska, prop jets, a pressurized, pretty fancy airplane for its time. In 1968, Ween was merged into Northern Consolidated. Northern Consolidated was a surviving corporation, but I felt that we should carry on the Ween name because I had a great admiration and love for Noel and Sig, and that is why how we have Ween Air Alaska now. There's some interesting anecdotes in the going back in those days. I remember when Tony Schultz first started flying, he was flying for Star. I was parked out in front of Carl I. Carlson's trading post at Akiak. They're on skis, and I was in with Carl I., and this airplane landed out here, this Star airplane landed, and in come this irate guy, Morgan Davies, who was flying for Star. And he says, "Peterson," he said, "what's the big idea?" He said, "letting that Oscar Winchell, who was working for me at that time, go out here and harass Tony Schultz. He's just a new young guy flying here and doing all these awful things to him." I said, "Is Oscar doing that?" "Yes, he sure is." I says, "Thank God." I says, when Oscar worked for Star, I says, "he made my life miserable for about 5 years. I'm sure happy to get revenge." Sam White, he mentioned Sam White. God, he was a grand guy. Sam was from Maine, and he could cook up a mess of bean hole beans like no one. And one time he come down here to Anchorage, because Sam lives up at Fairbanks, and he come down here, and Burley Putnam was the CA inspector, and Burley called up and said, "Say, Sam is down here. He says he'll," or Kirkpatrick was running the shop out here, called, and he said, "I'm going to clean up an oil can. Old Sam says to make us a mess of bean hole beans." Well, I said, "Doggone it, I won't be here tomorrow. I sure hope there's some left." And so I was gone for the day, and the day after that I walked out, and there was just absolutely no one in the field. And I went up, and Burley Putnam, the CA inspector, was up in his office, and he looked kind of pale. I said, "Where is everyone?" He says, "Bean hole beans." He says, "I've done bean hole beans." He says, "We've got everyone standing off close to the bathroom." "Oh?" I says, "Where's Sam?" "Oh," he says, "he's mad and he left. He says he's never coming back to Anchorage again." I says, "What happened?" "Well," he says, "we called him, when we referred to him as Sam White's bean hole bean, or Sam White's cold cure, he says he got mad. He says he didn't dare cough." He says, so that was a white story. Bill Lavery, of course, Bill Lavery was already a hero when I got here on April 1st, 1934, because he had gone through this terrific adventure with the Russians over in East Cape. And so he was quite a hero. When I started the Airways office here, on 414 4th, and in that office was the Lavery Airways, the Miro Air Service, out of Nordkotzebue, Christensen Air Service, and Cordova Air Service, and of course, Nina Ray Peterson Flying Service. So Bill and I got very well acquainted because we took care of his Anchorage end of the business, and he ran a very successful, he and Al Peterson did the flying. Al, we referred to as Roger. They just put the radios in service, and Al was on the radio, and when he was talking to the station, the CAA, and when they ended the conversation, they said, "Roger." He says, no, the name is Al." So from that time on, it was Roger. Of course, Bill later on sold his airline, to my chagrin, it was my own fault, to Star Air Service. I was interested in Bob Ellis's bookkeeping system because I use grocery store pads, and I just use these regular grocery store receipts. They were my invoices. They were my record for when I received money. They were receipts I gave out, and that was the whole bookkeeping system. And he's right. We were in the shopping business. When we come to town, we'd have a list of items. I think it was 50 cents minimum, and then the freight rate was heavier, one half of 1%, I believe, of the passenger fare. So it comes to about, usually, fare was $100, the freight rate was 50 cents. And that was a good part of our business. We had some interesting outside of Underhills. I had a couple of interesting experiences. I got a charter to Nome from Commander Woodward, the geodetic survey. He was up trying to locate the lakes and the islands in Alaska for the geographic position of Alaska so they could make some accurate maps, because they were, Kodiak Lake was off 8 miles, as I understand, and so he was up here doing this work. He and a fellow by the name of Cummins, who was the head of the Weather Bureau, we were all under using code at that time during the war, and a young fellow going up to the school up at White Mountain, I believe it was, he's working for William now, and one other passenger. And the day was absolutely clear. There wasn't a cloud in the sky from Bethel to Nome. It was the most beautiful day you ever saw. And as we got in the airplane, Cummins said, "What a beautiful day." And I said, "So far." We got up almost to Unalakleet, and I never saw a snowstorm or snowflakes as big and as black. I turned and ran, trying to outrun it, which was a mistake, and headed for back to Marshall. Well, it got so thick finally, and it was rolling hills, and I was following the river there, and it was a small river, and the hills were all white, and I couldn't see them, and Woodward was sitting in the right seat, and I said, "Now, Commander, I'm following this crooked stream," and it was just as crooked as a dog's hind leg. I said, "Now you watch that side." I said, "I'll watch my side and I'll make my turn. But when you see that river turn, you holler so I can make the turn, because this is all this haze out here is stuffed full of hills." Well, he did. He made a couple, and then he missed one. Well, I had a heck of a time getting back onto that river again. I did that about 3 times, and I knew that this was heading for disaster if something went wrong. And I saw an open bar with a big piece of driftwood in the middle of it. But it looked just like O'Hare to me, and I said, "I'm going to put this thing down. I don't care if I spend the rest of my life here." And I landed in this bar and splashed out into the river. But fortunately, it was kind of tapered down. And got back, and it stopped snowing after a couple of hours, and we got out of there. When we landed, Cummins said, "I see what you mean so far." He says, "I'm going on from Texas. I'm going back to Texas." And he did. He quit the Weather Bureau. So that was a kind of a hair raiser. But I'm glad to see all these military people here, Navy people, because we did quite a lot of that kind of work. The most interesting trip I had was I got a call from General Buckner's office, and they said, "We'd like to charter your Trenor Stinson to go down to Kodiak and deliver Colonel Bray with the aircraft detail, first aircraft detail." This is 4 days after Pearl Harbor. Well, I said, "Fine, I'll take the trip." And I had a young guy by the name of Jeffrey next to me. His brother-in-law was the head of G2 out there. And I think you military-type folks will tell me, or will agree with me, that probably the greatest rumor monger that you ever get is right in G2 itself. But anyway, he was my co-pilot, and we landed at Kodiak. There wasn't a darn thing at Anchorage. We'd had 10 old Sikorsky 236s, and they'd had some dive bombing practice off at Kakamath Bay and lost 7 of them. Either lost altogether or they were rivets were pulled and they couldn't use. So we had, for defense here, we had 3 of the old Sikorskys. And, of course, we were all setting solid because we knew there was a lack of defense at Kodiak. So into Kodiak we went, and boy, it was all not a soul, except a whole lot of young officers come running up. And I thought, boy, I said, "Where are all the airplanes? It's out on patrol." They said, "Have you seen our reinforcements?" I said, "Uh-oh." I said, "It's a good thing you got some good coast defense. If you need those pea shooters up there, they couldn't sink a rowboat." Jeffrey, who had spent a year in kitchen in the Navy, says, "Uh-oh, let's get out of here." He says, "A light cruiser will take this place." So, well, in the meantime, well, these guys were just absolutely in a panic. "Have you seen our reinforcements? And what kind of defense do you have at Anchorage?" I said, "Everything is fine at Anchorage." I said, plenty of defense there. Everything is good. And so we went into the DLQ that night, and we were there 2 days for weather. You had lit a match in that place. I think the Marines who were guarding the naval station had shot you right on the sight. That's how nervous people were. You remember General Corlett? He was the general there, and I can't remember. I don't think they had an admiral there at the time. Well, anyway, we finally had cleared up, and as soon as cleared up, I said, let's get the hell out of here. I didn't pay much attention to it. It was really clear weather. And so we fired up, and boy, am I glad to get out of Kodiak. Colonel Bray said, don't tell anyone what you saw here. I said, don't you worry. I said, this is an impregnable fortress as far as Anchorage is concerned, and I looked back. I said, when it comes to evacuating this country, I don't want anyone in my way, because this thing is, I said, those doggone Japs could take Kodiak, Anchorage, and Ladd Field, all concrete and nothing on it, nothing flat. Well, they had some evacuees out of there, and lo and behold, guess who two of them were? Mrs. General Ladd and Mrs. General Buckner. And we had some missionaries and so forth. So back to Anchorage we headed. Well, it began, the fog began closing in, and the whole darn country fogged in solid. Kenai, well, of course, there wasn't a field at Kenai, there wasn't any at Homer. There was, the only field was Anchorage. There was no other field. So, but it all fogged in anyway. It wouldn't make any difference. And I didn't have enough fuel to get to McGrath, which was clear. And this fog laid in except Elmendorf and Merrill Field. Well, I was landing at Merrill. By the time we got out here to Point Possession, Merrill Field had closed in. So I called the Elmendorf Tower and asked permission to land. Permission denied. This kind of tickled me. I stopped getting scared because Elmendorf was closing in. And there was about 1,000 feet on the south end of the north-south runway at Elmendorf, and I swear that's the only thing was open in the whole doggone valley. So this kind of tickled me, and I got out over here. Of course, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I was going to land in Elmendorf. So I didn't tell anyone about the passengers, and I asked for clearance again. Clearance denied. That's all I got. Just rush. Well, I said, this is a desperate situation. Nobody's running. Clearance denied. Well, I had the gear down, and I had the flaps down, and I had the props and low pitch. And I, on my approach, and I called in for clearance. Clearance denied. I said, would you call General Buckner and ask him what he'd like me to do with Mrs. Buckner and Mrs. Ladifard? Clearance granted. So when I hit that runway, as soon as the wheels touched, I just sat on the gyro and went back in the fog. It took 15 minutes to find me and get me back to the terminal. So we had a little fun too, you know, during the war. We had some interesting characters around. We had one of my favorites was Merle Sassy, very low, quiet talking sort of guy. I think he's the only honest pilot, truly 100% honest pilot I ever met. Sass was flying a Blanca for Star, and he went over across the inlet here someplace and landed in a little lake. And he'd not run between a couple of trees, knocked the wings off, and washed the airplane off. And I saw Sass and said, what in the devil happened over Beluga? Well, I come in a little bit too high and a little bit too fast, and I waited a little bit too long. I knew I was going to crack up either in the tops of the trees or the bottoms. I chose the bottoms. You'd have to know this guy to really, really appreciate him. He's one of the old timers here. He's old Dave Strandberg, who had a bunch of gold mines around the country. He liked to ride with Sass. He was always traveling. And he liked to ride with Sass. He always pushed the pilots. He liked to ride with Sass, I believe, because he knew instinctively that Sass couldn't be pushed. But he was pushing Sass one day to go across the pass, through Rennie Pass into McGrath. And old Sass didn't want to go, but finally said, well, I'll take old Dave on this trip. Well, they got up in bad weather up in snowing up through Ptarmigan Valley, and Sass was a great cigar smoker, and smoking his cigar and wind the window down, wipe the windshield off. And old Dave began to squirm, and finally he says, "Sass," he says, "don't you ever get scared?" And Sass took the cigar out of his mouth and calmly said, "Dave, I'm always scared in these things." I think that's about enough. Don Glass come up here in the Ford Trimotor 1934 with Frank Dorbrandt. Kind of an interesting little story about old Don. He was sitting up on the wing of this Ford with the wrinkled skin, as you recall, and someone said, "What are you doing up there? I thought you were the co-pilot." "Oh," he said, I spend so much time sitting up on this wing," he says, "my hind end is getting like a waffle." And from that time, it wasn't Don Glass anymore, it was Waffle Ass. Well, I realize that First Liar doesn't have much of a chance here, but I've done my very best. I don't think anything on my notes that needs anything. So, can we roll the Western here, Cass?
Our next program piece is going to be a film that's been donated for our use here today by Ween Alaska, or Ween Air Alaska as they're known nowadays. It's the film By the Seat of Our Pants. Our next speaker represents another legend in Alaska's flying history, and I'd also like to take this time to thank him publicly for the support that he's given the Alaskan Historical Aircraft Society in the past and his efforts to preserve our history up here. I'm sorry that his father couldn't make it, but in true tradition, Dick Reeve is here to speak to us today about the Reeve history in Alaska. Dick Reeve.
Ladies and gentlemen, following Ray Peterson is always a rather onerous ordeal. After all, he's had many more years of telling lies than I have. But he did set the stage quite well when he came on, because he did say the First Liar didn't stand a chance. He realized that, and Ray, I congratulate you on from what I know, a rather factual presentation this afternoon. I mention Raz Ray because we've known each other for about 35 or 36 years. In fact, we were next door neighbors, thanks to my father. But be that as it may, you'd much more like to hear now about Bob Reeve, one of the other pioneer Alaska bush pilots that helped build aviation in Alaska. Bob Reeve was born in Wanakee, Wisconsin in 1902. His comment about that year was that the weather was so bad that not an airplane got off the ground. And he's right, because the Wright brothers didn't fly until December of 1903. But Bob Reeve was always an energetic, active, and independent fellow. Now, I'm going to be showing a movie which lasts about 30 minutes, and it highlights Bob Reeve's life. It is more of a personal living history than it is about the development of aviation in Alaska. I see Herb Hilscher sitting up in the back here. Herb was the moving force behind the film that you're going to see. Several years ago, he came to Bob Reeve and said, "Bob," he says, "you've got an awful lot of history behind you." He says, "We've got to make a movie about that." And Dad said, "Herb, that's a good idea." And Herb started expounding on all of the things that had to be done, and we've got to do this, and we've got to do that. And finally, my dad said, "Wait a minute, Herb," says, "who's going to pay for this?" And Herb said, "Well, Bob, you are." Right then and there, what started out as a one-hour film went to slightly less than 30 minutes. But in any event, Herb, who's here, was the fellow that put it together. I'm going to talk about Bob Reeve a little bit, keeping in mind that there will be lapses and so forth in what I say, because the film will fill in those areas better than I can. Bob Reeve ran away from home in Wanakee, Wisconsin, towards the end of World War II. He was 15 years old at the time and wanted to get in on the fighting before it was over. He and his twin brother ran away. Bob Reeve lied his way into the Army, which he came out of 2 years later as a sergeant. Twin brother Dick Reeve lied his way into the Navy and continued a military career through 1938, at which time he was an Air Corps officer and ran out of luck in a Douglas B-18 in southern Illinois. In any event, after World War I, Bob Reeve kicked around, and this will be described somewhat in the film. He'll make reference to Vladivostok, and I should amplify on that. As he says in the movie, he was deported from Vladivostok, which was the roughest, toughest town in Siberia at that time. He then goes on in the movie to describe his first taste of Alaska, which was, and the Aleutians for that matter, which was via ship. Went back, and in the movie also tells about how he became enamored with the airplane business. His reasoning was slightly different than Ray Peterson's, but it had the same end result. He finally came to Alaska in 1932 and founded Reeve Airways. That will be explained in the movie also. Now, there's some footage that shows the Fairchild 51 that Bob Reeve was operating in 1937, stuck in what appears to be some very deep snow. That's a fact. In the summer of 1937, a young mountaineer, or two young mountaineers by the name of Brad Washburn and Bob Bates, corresponded with Bob Reeve. Their goal was to climb Mount La Pena, which is just a few miles from Mount St. Elias, Mount Logan on the Alaska-Canada border. Bob Reeve said, "Yes, certainly, I'll take you in there. Anywhere you'll ride, I'll fly." The footage you'll see is at 8,500 feet. The Fairchild 51 had about 300 horsepower. The month was June. Fabry thought that he could get the mountaineers onto the glacier and get out again. He got hit by a very warm summer storm. The snow turned to mush and slush, and there he was for about 5 days. There's more films of old-time Valdez there. There's not too much in the film about World War II. We were traveling from the Southern 48 in December of 1942, and my first recollection of World War II is seeing it in the headlines when we were in Juneau. Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. At that time, Pan-Alaska or Pan-American Airways, whichever it was called in 1941, was operating from Seattle through Juneau to Fairbanks, and we were flying on that airplane. When we returned to Fairbanks, Dad, Bob Reeve, realized that there was going to be a substantial amount of military activity in Alaska. And he made arrangements, or started making plans within his own mind as to how he could contribute to the war effort. He was a little old for the Second War. He was just a little too young for the First War. But he had decided that he was going to do his part. One of the military activities in the early 1940s was to establish a chain of airports and a logistical supply line from the domestic, or the then 48 states, up through Canada and into Alaska. The military intent at that time, naturally, was to win the war from the Japanese, in addition to defending North America. And it appeared most feasible to launch the attack on Japan through Alaska and through the Aleutian Islands, because there was U.S. territory nowhere any closer to Japan. Consequently, airports were being built in addition to northwestern Canada. The first airport inside the Alaska border was at Northway. Of course, Ladfield was under construction. Elmendorf Air Force Base, which originally was part of Fort Richardson, and Galena, McGrath, Nome, the airport at King Salmon just out of Naknek, and several points down the Alaska Peninsula and into the Aleutian Islands, namely Port Hayden, Cold Bay, which was named Thornboro Air Force Base, Dutch Harbor, which was a Navy installation, and just 50 miles farther beyond Umnak, two airports there, Cape Air Force Base and Berry Field. See Slim Walters here, and he remembers all of them from when we first started flying scheduled operations. Then on out to Adak and Chitka, Chemyonat too. Of course, the military people, I'm sure, will expand on those operations tomorrow. Getting back to the airport at Northway, the first one to be built inside the Alaska border, Bob Reeve contracted with the military authorities to haul all of the supplies in there. Northway was out in the middle of a great big swamp, so supplies, of course, had to come up by ship. There was no Alaska highway at that time. The ship offloaded the construction materials for Northway at Valdez, where they were hauled by Caterpillar and AP wagon to a point called Nabesna. There was an old gold mine at Nabesna, which had been operated for years by Carl Whittem. First things to be done there, of course, was to build an airstrip at Nabesna, which was 50 miles across the swamp from where Northway was to be built. Dad went over to Northway the first time and hired some of the local Athabascan Indians there to clear out the stumps and knock the tops off the tundra so that he could begin flying his Fairchild 71 in with the initial materials and supplies to set up a construction camp for the construction crew. As that was going on, Frank Barr, were you there at that time? Frank flew for Bob Reeve, and I'm sure he has some more interesting stories to tell also. Bob Reeve had located a Boeing 88. It was a Boeing aircraft built in 1928, used in the first transcontinental air service. It was a biplane, had three engines and three vertical fins. In any event, it could carry a substantial load. I get the impression that he stuffed as much as 10,000 pounds in it every once in a while. With that Boeing 88, which everyone called the Yellow Peril, all of the materials and supplies were hauled into Northway to build a paved 5,000-foot airport and all of the assorted buildings and so forth that go with operating an airport. The Northway construction project was finished, I guess, in the summer of 1942 or thereabouts. We then piled all of the family goods. I specifically remember the the washing machine in front of me in the cabin, and flew to Anchorage, landed at Merrill Field, and at Merrill Field, Bob Reeve established what was the beginnings of Reeve Aleutian Airways. Okay, this is September of 1942. The military services were, as usual, short on transportation, and so Bob Reeve entered into a contract arrangement with the Alaska Communications System. He became, which was a branch of U.S. Army Signal Corps. He was their Air Force. I remember traveling as an unauthorized non-military passenger with him. He frequently took me on trips to get me out of my mother's hair. But we traveled all over Alaska. I remember spending a night in Galena and seeing the old Russian low-wing fixed landing gear bombers fly overhead, all of the Lend-Lease aircraft that were flowing through Alaska en route to Russia. Nome was very much the same. There were a substantial number of Russian military people there. We even stopped in at McKinley Park, which by 1942-43 had a short airport of its own. As I recall, the only mode of transportation at McKinley Park at that time, other than the trains coming through, were some GI-issue bicycles. They were painted olive drab. They did not have white sidewalls or anything, but only the adults were allowed to ride them. So I had to wait several more years before I could do anything besides sit on my dad's lap and fly an airplane. The Boeing 88 that I mentioned that was used to build Northway was subsequently sold to MK, Morris Knudsen Construction Company, and was, I think, operated by Mudhole Smith for MK until the end of the war. In the meantime, Bob Reeve had acquired a second Boeing 88, which was black, and so rather than being called the Yellow Peril, as 224 and the yellow one was called, this one became the Black Mariah. Amchitka was being built towards the end of World War II in 1944 or thereabouts. Radar was just coming onto the scene, and an emergency mission of military nature arose in the summer of 44, which took my dad and the black Boeing 88 with a substantial amount of highly classified materials and about 10 passengers out onto the Alaska Peninsula and into the Aleutians. The ultimate destination, as we were to learn later, was Amchitka, which was then a very highly secret military airfield way out in the Aleutians in the middle of nowhere. In any event, on this trip with the Black Mariah, one of the fueling stops was to be Cold Bay, which is 620 miles southwest of here at the end of the Alaska Peninsula. As usual, the weather went to pot. My father had flown up and down the Alaska Peninsula and a little bit out into the Aleutians with a single-engine Fairchild the two previous years. But this time with the Boeing 88, he got caught. Cold Bay went flat, and he had no gas left, and finally ended up ditching the Boeing 88 about 75 miles north of Cold Bay on the north side of the Alaska Peninsula. There's one interesting aspect of the story. There were the 10 or 11 people that were on board suffered only minor injuries. The airplane was landed in the surf, went up on its nose, and apparently some of them got squashed a little bit when the boxes of radar equipment shifted. But they all had to wade to shore. They got their survival gear out of the aircraft with no problem, blankets, a little bit of food apparently, and the primary item, a case of old Tom Burns whiskey. And all of them claim that that is the only thing that did allow them to survive. And there's got to be a grain of truth to that also, because the accident happened at just about dark, which would have been 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night during that part of the year. They groped around, built a fire, and eventually all rolled up together in their wet blankets past the several bottles of Tom Burns back and forth until everyone fell asleep. Well, the fire went out, and the first fellow that woke up the next morning got awfully nervous and let out quite a large yelp because he'd discovered that sometime during the night after the fire had gone out, a great big brown bear had come scavenging down the beach and had made tracks right to the pile of blankets. And apparently was quite interested in having himself a feast. Fortunately, though, about 2 feet from the head of the closest person rolled up in the blankets was a half full fifth of Tom Burns whiskey. And it was obvious from the bear's footprints what had happened. The bear was coming straight on to the feast. He caught a whiff of that rotten old Tom Burns whiskey and had dug all of his 4 feet in and headed up off the beach and onto the tundra. So that gets us to 1944, thereabouts. In the meantime, we spent an awful lot of time at Elmendorf. I suspect because Bob Reeve liked to be with aviators and not with the competition. I remember the B-18s, which were stationed at Elmendorf, and then as the base was developed, along came the B-26s and the B-25s and the B-17s, and it was always quite a thrill to see one of the B-24s, which of course was a four-engine high-wing bomber, extremely long range. World War II naturally took a turn after the military leaders saw what a substantial task it was going to be to try to invade Japan through the Aleutians. It seemed that the final analysis was that more people were going to be lost in the Aleutians because of the weather and storms than were going to survive to conduct the invasion on Japan. So, of course, the war then shifted to the South Pacific, and that's a matter of another bit of history. As with Ray Peterson, at the end of World War II, there were many surplus aircraft available. Reeve Airways also acquired some surplus C-47s, and as Ray Peterson noted, because of grandfather rights and so forth, started flying in separate geographic areas of Alaska. Bob Reeve was always of the mind that scheduled airlines weren't where the money was to be made and where the action was and so forth. And he was bound and determined to be a general charter operator and fly all over Alaska. Well, between Ray Peterson and some legal assistance and so forth, he filed for a scheduled route into the Aleutian Islands.